Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, a podcast that has dedicated itself to the discussion and review of public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and with me as always is my podcasting muse, Lydia.
I'm acting in silent. How did I do?
I was going to say, this is because it's a silent film this month, isn't it?
Give everybody about 3 seconds to go, wait, did it stop playing? It's still playing.
I almost put in some sort of pun about it being silent or something like that. And I thought, no, Lydia will give me the whole.
Oh, the only time I'm silent.
Yes. Well, before we go any further, thanks to everyone for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphan Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcast. And wherever you choose to listen, if you have the option to do so, please rate and review the show. It does help get the show out to more people. Another great way to help is just by sharing the episode you're listening to on any social media platform you might use. You can follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel. And if you'd like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. And we actually got a couple emails this Yay. Past month. Lee Perkins gave you an idea of where you might be able to find Desert Hawk finally.
Yes, I was so excited. You texted me the other day and said, check your email. And he sent us a great link. I think it's called the DVD Lady. And you can actually buy the Desert Hawk from them either in a physical form like a DVD or by a digital form. So I am really excited. They promised delivery for the digital format within 3 days. I'm super excited to get that from them. And I may or may not remember to update you guys here, but if it doesn't work out, I'll try to let you know, at least on Facebook, where I am part of the Facebook group. And I'm so excited. That's Richard Green, Yvonne DiCarlo, and very, very, very young Rock Hudson. Before he was Rock Hudson. No, he was Rock Hudson by then. But, it's such a fun movie. It's just one of those weird little swashbucklers that, you know, it's just a lot of fun. So I'm excited to get it. Yay. Thank you so much, Lee. I really appreciate that reference.
Yeah, that was awesome. As soon as I saw that email, I was like, oh, this is going to make Lydia's day.
Oh, it did. Absolutely. I think I got your text at like 10 o'clock at night. And I think I might have woken my husband up squealing.
We also got a letter from Abby Land. Now, we have heard from this person once before. They gave us some really great movie recommendations, which I believe we've actually covered here on the show. They write, Dear Christopher and Lydia, hello. I wrote to you last year with movie recommendations. I appreciate that you took the time to watch the films I suggested, and I'm glad you enjoyed Hotel for Women. Oh, yay. Well, thank you. I was trying to remember which ones it was. It's right here in the letter.
Hotel
for Women
was such a great movie.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for recommending that one. I just listened to the February episode on Kept Husbands, and I have an answer to Lydia's request for better romances with a rich girl and a poor man.
Yay! Oh, I'm so excited.
Adorable, from 1933, is a fluffy romantic comedy about a princess who falls in love with a military man. While the princess's power and social clout does have an effect on the relationship, I think it does a better job of handling the romance as it is shown that the couple is smitten with each other before they discover the other's identity.
Oh, that's so great. That's one of those things I love about Ever After. It's the Cinderella story, but they actually meet each other before anybody knows who anybody is. So, that's a great reference. Thank you. Or referral, I should say.
While I'm writing, there's a few other movies I wanted to suggest for the podcast. I recently watched Murder at the Windmill from 1949, alternate title Mystery at the Burlesque. After a man is killed at the Windmill Theater, police keep the cast late to run through the entire performance again and deduce who had the opportunity to commit murder. Don't go into this film with the expectation of a tightly plotted mystery. While the solution does make sense in retrospect, the film doesn't dole out much information for the audience to play detective with. The focus is on the jokes and musical numbers. Most of the musical numbers aren't overly long, and a good number of the jokes got a chuckle out of me. It's not Agatha Christie, but it's a fun romp.
That sounds like fun. That reminds me a little bit of Murder by Death. If you guys haven't seen that, look it up.
I love the premise. They're like, well, let's do the performance again so we can figure out who's off stage long enough to...
I love that. I'm one of those morbid people that wants to see it both times.
And then they continue, The Green Murder Case, 1929, is the opposite. It's a film that wants you to pay attention. I started thinking about this one after listening to your Charlie Chan episode. This is my favorite out of the Philo Vance movies I've seen, and one I appreciate more after reading the book it's based on, which I didn't like nearly as much. It follows Vance investigating a series of murders within the mansion of a wealthy family. William Powell is perfect in the role, and the movie holds your attention throughout.
Oh, did you hear me gasp? I love William Powell.
Oh, as soon as I saw that name, I was like, oh, Lydia William Powell.
Yep, yes.
I hope you like these films, and once again, thank you for all your hard work you do creating the podcast. Sincerely, Abby. So, Abby, thank you so much. That is a fantastic letter and some more fantastic recommendations. You really know how to kind of hit all the right notes when it comes to recommending to us.
Oh, absolutely. I'm excited. And seriously, we love getting recommendations. As much fun as it might be to say, oh, yeah, we should watch, you know, 10 Little Indians or something like that. I love having movies that are vetted by other people because some of the things we pick, it's a real, and I'm going to say this correctly, a crapshoot. Mm-hmm. Because we're limited to what we know. So if you guys know something we don't know, tell us. Please tell us.
Oh, absolutely. I think 99% of the films that we cover, we've never watched before.
Yeah.
We're going strictly on, oh, okay, this isn't public domain. Let's read the blurb. Yes. That sounds interesting. Oh, it stars this person or it has mm-hmm. this historical significance. So let's check this one out.
Yeah.
It is so great actually getting, oh, I've watched this film and I think you'd like it too. Oh, that is brilliant, which is what, you know, Abby did with Hotel for Women, which we really enjoyed. And that was a lot of fun. So, I mean, we will double check on some of these films and see what the copyright status is. The Green Murder Case from 29, if it's not copyright, if it's not out of copyright now, it will be next year. Yeah. So that's awesome. But I will double check on The Murder at the Windmill. And Adorable from 33 is a possibility then.
Yeah, those sound like such good recommendations. They sound fun.
They sound fun to watch either way, whether we cover them here on the show or not. I think I might dig them up and watch them anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
All right. Again, if you wanted to, anyone else has any recommendations or you wanted to write us, orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. So let's listen to an Ellery Queen 1 Minute Mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we get silent and watch for the street angel.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with the case I call The Counterfeit Politician. Among the many assignments I've had over the years, one I really enjoy is documenting the truth of historical papers, particularly when there's money involved. In this case, the document was a memorandum written by the President of the United States to a deputy, stating that it was perfectly all right if his vice president were given the oath of office outside the United States. The Examiner claimed it was a horrendous hoax, but I told him, it's worth a fortune. In a moment, I'll tell you why.
Okay, you know what it's like. You're flicking through Amazon or the local DVD shop when suddenly you discover a film that you haven't seen in years, but which you remember as being legendary. The purchase is hastily made, you invite friends over, make popcorn and settle down to watch this classic. But then it becomes apparent that your mind has double-crossed you, and that this film is frankly awful. Soon your friends have deserted you, your boss says he has to let you go, and even your dog won't come when you call. How did it go so wrong? Well, in the interests of public harmony, a new podcast, I Saw That Years Ago, sets out to watch the old films that your memory has convinced you are brilliant, but which in reality could be anything but. So join me, your host Martin Darkley, and my compatriot, Gentleman Joe, as we watch the old films so you don't have to. Find us at www.isawthatyearsago.com or on iTunes.
In the case of The Counterfeit Politician, the memorandum offered for sale was real. The vice president in Franklin Pierce's administration actually took the oath of office in Cuba. Listen. listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
In Naples, Italy, young Angela, desperate for the money needed to buy medicine for her ailing mother, attempts to resort to prostitution to earn it. She has little luck, so tries to grab a pile of bills off a counter of a local food stall. She runs directly into the arms of the police, who arrest her for stealing while soliciting, and she is sentenced to a year in the workhouse. She manages to escape during an altercation between two prisoners. She makes it back home to find her mother has died. The police track her down, and it is only due to the kindness of a group from a traveling carnival that she is able to elude them. She begins traveling with the carnival and becomes part of a balancing act. During a stop, she meets a young, handsome painter, Gino, who instantly becomes smitten with her. He joins the troupe so he can be close to her, and the two eventually fall in love. After an accident during one of her performances, Angela's ankle was broken, so Gino takes her back to Naples to find a doctor to help her. There, they try and build a life together, with Gino seeking consignment work for his paintings. Just as their lives look to be taking a turn for the better after Gino secures a well-paying job to paint a large mural in town, Angela's past catches up to her when a police officer recognizes her. Worried that if Gino finds out about why she must go to prison, he'd never be able to paint again, she arranges to spend a last hour with him before being led off to the workhouse by the officer. The next morning, Gino is distraught at Angela's disappearance and finds his muse has left him and he cannot paint any longer. Angela, thinking Gino is out in the world doing great things, happily does her time and is eventually released. Meanwhile, Gino has found out about her incarceration and thinks that she fooled and betrayed him. Determined to find and paint a woman as he feels they really are, Gino heads to the wharf to find a face of an angel with a blackened soul. When by chance he finds Angela, it becomes a struggle between their broken hearts and the true love they once shared. And I usually kind of shorten the synopsis and don't say all that much, but this one being the silent film, there won't be any clips in this episode or anything. I figured I could give away a little bit more.
Yeah, fair enough. So yes, in case you missed it, this is a silent film.
Yes, it is. Janet Gaynor is our star here. She began her career as an extra in silent films. She appeared in about 20 films from 1924 to 1926. Largely uncredited, and then she signed on with Fox Films in 1926, and within a few years would be one of the biggest box office draws of the time. In 1929, she was awarded the first Academy Award for Best Actress for her performances in three films, Seventh Heaven, Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, both from 1927, and Street Angel. This is the only time an actress would win for multiple roles. At the time, the award was given to highlight the total recent work of an actor and not a specific role or film. This would be changed a few years later by a new rule instituted by the Academy. She was not only the first recipient, but the youngest at age 22, until 1986 when 21-year-old Marley Matlin won for Children of a Lesser God.
Wow, that is a long record to hold.
Yeah, impressive. Gaynor was one of the handful of lead actresses to successfully transition from silent to sound pictures. She was repeatedly teamed up with actor Charles Farrell. The pair were known as America's favorite lovebirds. They started working together in the aforementioned Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, and they'd appear in a total of 12 films together, including the 1929 musical Sunnyside Up. She continued to be one of Fox's most popular actresses through the early 30s. She got top billing in 1933 State Fair, and in 1935's The Farmer Takes a Wife, which introduced Henry Fonda to the screen as her leading man. When Daryl Zanuck merged his 20th Century Pictures with Fox to form 20th Century Fox in 1935, she suddenly found herself competing for parts with the likes of up-and-coming actresses like Loretta Young and Shirley Temple. She still received top billing in 1937's Ladies in Love, over Loretta Young, Tyrone Power, and Constance Bennett, who was at the time the highest-paid actress in Hollywood. But her popularity was beginning to wane. In polls, she slipped to number 24 in the most popular list.
Wow.
She came close to retiring at this point. Studio execs continued to cast her in the roles that made her famous, but audiences' tastes were changing, and she was feeling that she wasn't being given the opportunity to change along with them. When 20th Century Fox wanted to renegotiate her contract and demote her to a featured player rather than a leading star, Gaynor left the studio. David O. Selznick quickly offered her the leading role for a film that was being produced at his Selznick International Pictures. She accepted the part, and the Technicolor romantic drama was released in 1937. A Star Is Born would become an enormous success and would give her her second nomination for Best Actress, which she lost to Louise Rainer for The Good Earth. After that, she starred in the 1938 film The Young at Heart with Paulette Goddard, and the comedy was a modest success, but Gaynor was ready to retire. She explained in 1939, when she announced her marriage to fashion designer Gilbert Adrian, "I had been working steadily for 17 long years. Making movies was really all I knew of life. I just wanted to have time to know other things. Most of all, I wanted to fall in love. I wanted to get married. I wanted a child. And I knew that in order to have those things, one had to make time for them. So I simply stopped making movies. Then, as if by a miracle, everything I really wanted happened."
I heard you say something just now, or I think you said it, or maybe I just skimmed over it. You mentioned that she was in 1933's Adorable, which was just recommended to us by Abby Lane. So, interesting little link there, yeah.
Absolutely. Gaynor would return to acting, albeit on live television, in the 1950s, appearing on series such as Medallion Theater, Lux Video Theater, and the General Electric Theater. She'd make her final film screen appearance in 1957 as Dick Sargent's mother in the musical comedy Bernadine. In 1959, she made her stage debut in the play The Midnight Sun, which premiered in New Haven, Connecticut, but it was not well received and it closed shortly after its debut. She did appear in Broadway in 1980 as Maud in a stage adaptation of Harold and Maud, and she received good reviews, but the play overall was panned by critics. That same year, she appeared in the series The Love Boat, and this would be her last screen role. Her final acting role was on a touring production of On Golden Pond in 1982.
Aww.
Charles Farrell, as I said earlier, appeared in a dozen films with Gaynor. The two were romantically linked for some time before her eventual marriage. He started out as a bit player for Paramount, appearing in features like The Hunchback of Notre Dame and the 1923 silent version of The Ten Commandments. When he signed on with Fox, he was paired with Gaynor. At first, he transitioned to talkies easily, but his Boston elite dialect fell out of favor with Fox, and they continually offered him roles that he felt were beneath him. As his acting career began to wind down, he and fellow actor Ralph Bellamy opened the Palm Springs Racquet Club in 1934. In 1942, he joined the Navy, where he worked as an administrative officer, as well as spent some time on the USS Hornet. After leaving the service, he was heavily involved in developing Palm Springs area. He was elected to the city council in 46 and served as the mayor from 47 to 55. Over the years, he made appearances on the Jack Benny radio show and returned to the screen between 1952 and 1955 as the father in My Little Margie. He starred as a fictionalized version of himself from 1956 to 1960 on the Charles Farrell show, where he played an owner of a racquet club. He did sell the club in 59 for a reported $1.2 million. That's over $12 million in today's dollars, if you're curious. And returned as the club operator in 65. Soon after, he retired altogether and moved to his Palm Springs desert property, where he lived quietly with his wife until her death in 1969 and his passing in 1990. Director Frank Borzage started in Hollywood as an actor in 1912 and continued to act until 1917, but began directing in 1913 on the short film The Mystery of the Yellow Aster Mine, and on the film The Pitch o' Chance in 1915. He worked exclusively as a director from 17 onwards. He directed 14 films between 1917 and 1919 alone.
Oh.
The peak of his career was in the late silent and early sound era. He won the first Academy Award for Best Director for the 1927 film The Seventh Heaven, which starred Janet Gaynor and Charles Farrell. He'd win a second Oscar for directing 1931's Bad Girl. He was known for lush romantic films, often dealing with young lovers overcoming adversity with love and in the end triumphing. Many obstacles that his lovers would have to overcome are World War I, disabilities, depression, and the rise of Nazism. He worked solidly from the 19-teens until 1948 and sporadically between 48 and 1961. His last film, Journey Beneath the Desert, he began but became too ill and Edgar Ulmer took over. Borzage was unfortunately uncredited for the sequences he completed. Watching Gaynor and Farrell in this film, I can definitely see why the studios kept putting these two together.
Mm-hmm.
They did have some great chemistry. And the fact that you could see this chemistry without hearing a word, just watching them, is really impressive.
It is. This is a lot.
I think the first thing that really struck me with this film is the camera work.
Before we jump into that.
Yeah.
Okay. I have one more credit I want to mention.
Okay, sure.
So it is worth mentioning, absolutely worth mentioning, that this movie is co-written, and I'm going to say it wrong, Monckton Hoff is one of the co-writers on this. He was also one of the two writers on Preston Sturges' The Lady Eve, which is one of the all-time best films ever made. So when I made that connection, I thought, no wonder this is such an interesting movie. And of course, won a number of Academy Awards in the very first Academy Awards. But definitely, if you didn't pick that up when you were, you know, checking through this, it's worth mentioning that, of course, the writers and the actors went on to do a lot of great things. I'm sorry, the director and the actors went on to do a lot of great things. But this writer is top notch as well, which is interesting because it's a silent movie. How do you gauge a really good writer in a silent movie? Well, we're probably about to find out.
Yeah, we'll see. Did a little bit of digging to try to see if I could find, like, is there a place that you can find scripts for silent films?
Oh, gosh. And
sometimes you can, but unfortunately, I couldn't find one for this one. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be like a new sort of side quest of mine, is just to find collections of scripts from silent films.
What an intro. I wonder what, I mean, is it called a script?
I would have to be. I mean, they are acting. They have dialogue. They have more dialogue than just what you see on the little, you know, the occasional title card. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be an entire story.
Yeah.
And it, like, I'm seeing it. Yes. I want to read it.
That's you know, what's really funny is everything I know, you guys are going to laugh. Everything I know about directing silent films comes from Singing in the Rain. That scene where they're walking across all the sound stages and they've got the megaphone and they're yelling, now grab it and throw more fire on, guys. I want more smoke, bigger dances. And that's how I imagine all movies being made at this time. And it's so funny to sit here and watch this silent film and imagine the sound going on the stage while they're filming. I admit I get a little bit distracted sometimes when I'm watching movies, but I thought, how interesting at this time, literally people, you know, we're just about to talk about the camera work, and it's the very opening scene. There's a part where somebody comes running down a set of stairs and it's on a set. And I thought that must have been crazy noisy, but they couldn't pick it up. Well, there was no microphone.
Yeah, and it's that opening scene, the entire town square, and the camera pans around and it does this whole like 180 degree loop, and it goes back and it goes forward. It's very fluid and it's just moving all over the place. And I was like, that is amazing. Why is it that? How did we lose this skill at the camera when you get into the 30s? And then it occurred to me, they didn't have to worry about making noise.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I read somewhere that this is the first tracking panning shot caught on film. And it's on there. It's put up on different places as being the first one to do this. And I think we lost a bit of what you're talking about. I think Citizen Kane won a whole lot of awards for having this kind of camera motion. Mm-hmm. And that's a really fascinating idea. It didn't occur to me that that would have been why, but you're exactly right. This was early. These cameras, gosh, how much did these cameras weigh? Hundreds of pounds.
Right.
And so to get them to move, I think the thing about this shot, and it's the opening shot of the movie, and it's what, 3-5 minutes long, 3 minutes long, probably at least, is that it is so fluid. It doesn't feel jerky. Like sometimes we'll see in later films where they try to do this, but the motion of the camera is a little bit jerky, a little bit rough. And in this one, it's really interesting because you're right. It'll pan up to a point of interest and then, you know, and then pan down or tilt up, I should say, tilt up and then tilt down. And then it goes left and then it goes back right a little bit and it follows somebody, but then it catches the eye. I love there is a man walking along with two women on his arm. And then he turns off and looks at something and then it continues to follow the two women off as they go. It's such an interesting, it tells such a story. You are getting in this single shot, this incredible view of what this city looks like, what the people are like that live in this neighborhood, the people that are transient, that are just traveling through it, what they're like, what their conversations and their arguments are like. You get to see people that, you know, don't belong here and get, you know, they get discriminated against by the police, and the people that do belong here, you know, coming out on top, even though maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. The whole bit where the guy gets shoved in, something happens in the drum on the circus, this big giant drum gets broken, and you're thinking, you know, it's a little bit funny. You're just getting captivated and pulled in by all this, not realizing that later that's going to matter, which is a great example of what great direction this is. The story writing is so good, but you get pulled into this. And even though you're told it's Naples under Mount Vesuvius, smoking Mount Vesuvius, that doesn't mean a lot at this point in time. There's not that level of travel going on right now. We're only a decade after World War I, and a lot of stuff is still broken down, being reconstructed, you know, not like World War II, but there's still a lot of, you know, that kind of repressed society going on in the world. And so you're getting this really gritty view of the way that these people live and try and survive. It's so much fun to see, and it draws you in, and it's all silent. We do it now by having big explosions and ridiculous stuff and funny lines. You got to have a funny line to catch people's attention. And there's nothing. In my case, I'm going to put this out here right now. The first time I watched it, I actually watched it silent. I had all of the sound off, and I'm going to talk probably in a little bit about what kind of impact that had on my viewing experience with this movie in particular. But the ability to tell a story and really draw you in and help you understand the setting in this first shot is incredible. I think that's my 3 minutes.
Yeah, it does set you up for just, you know, you're going to watch a film that is going to be a little bit more exceptional than maybe you were expecting, just because of that opening scene and those mm-hmm. opening moments. And it doesn't disappoint, I don't think. I do think, and we'll get into it, when we get into a little bit more of the story, I think there are some story elements that are like, a little iffy here and there. But as we're introduced to our leads and our cast and everything and how everything transpires, it is just, it pulled me in right away. And this is about an hour and 40 some minutes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's a silent film, but at no point while watching this film did I feel like, oh, when is this going to be over?
Yeah. Or when is it going to start? A lot of movies, you're like, okay, get to the plot. Nope, it goes right away.
Yeah, it really jumps off right away, and it just keeps going. For a film that is, at its core, I guess, a drama, it does have plenty of some humorous moments. Mm-hmm. And it starts out pretty much with one, with the traveling carnival going through and him being, hey, you stole my sausage. And we got to sit there the whole time this conversation's going on. This guy is... got this giant sausage in his hand, kind of just bouncing in front of the camera. It's a really weird and kind of funny scene.
It is a drama. It's listed as a drama. It definitely plays as a drama. And I think it jumps into that pretty quickly. You do get that little bit of humor, and I think it's really needed in this movie to have those little moments of humor. But they also do a really good job of connecting the people. I think you get these... I mean, it doesn't show up yet, but there's a clown with a monkey with a little you know, monkey with dressed up with his ruff and his hat and all of that. And they come in a little bit later. But you go from this pretty humorous, you know, kind of vignette of, you know, these, you don't really know where it's going. It's obviously some circus performers, and you just don't know where it's going, because if you're like me, you've never watched this movie before. But then it goes up and you meet Angela, and she is at the bedside of her mother. You assume it's her mother. I don't remember. It must say, you know, my mother. And I think I came into this movie immediately knowing that Janet Gaynor won an award for it. And so I was really paying attention to the acting. And it was interesting. I think I had expected it to be very kind of showy, very almost a pantomime. And even starting with her mother being sick and feverish in bed, it didn't feel like that. It felt like, yeah, this is kind of what a person would maybe behave like if they were, you know, feverish in bed. There are I would call them heavy-handed. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but there are some heavy-handed moments. She's obviously trying. It's incredible. For the length of this movie, there are remarkably few dialogue cards.
Yeah, it's true.
There are huge stretches where the doctor says, you better, you know, get her the medication quick. She's in danger. And she and Angela asks, how much is it? And he says, it's going to be 20 lira. We have no point of reference for how much money that is, but you get the idea very quickly. That's a lot of money to her, you know? And so there's the heavy handed, she digs in the purse, there's no money, you know? And then she goes and she's looking out the window and she looks down and here's a woman who's obviously a lady of the night, we'll call her. And she, you know, gets picked up by a guy pretty quickly, and you get where it's going. You know, it's maybe those aren't the mental leaps that we would make in today's society. But at the time, you can kind of see where she's like, I need a lot of money fast. And they play this off, and I think they play it off in a really good way, where good is the wrong word to use, but a convincing way, where she's desperate. She's literally mm-hmm. desperate. And I appreciated that it was a moment of desperation, that her mother is dying. It wasn't, I need money to pay the rent, guess I'll go be a prostitute. It was, my mother is going to die, the doctor just told me so, if I don't get her this medicine really fast. So it's interesting, even though there's a level of elevated dramatism to it, there is also, they work, I think, really hard for believability in the situation. They're telling you this is a woman who will do anything to save her mother, literally anything, but at heart, she's a really good person, and she's making this choice for somebody else, you know. And then it's interesting because it goes from there into her trying to pick up men, and the yes. men are not interested. One of them, I think, even pats her on the head and pinches her cheek, like, "Oh, you're such a cute little girl," you know.
Right. I really appreciated that she did a really great job of conveying that this was not an easy decision. This mm-hmm. was not, yeah, like you said. It wasn't just, oh, well, I'll be a prostitute and I'll go and do it. Even when she decides that she's going to do it, she's still the entire time going down and like convincing herself that this is what she has to do. Mm-hmm. She conveys that really, really well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then her watching the other girls on the street and then trying to mimic them and emulate them and everything. And that actually gives a little, again, just the slightest touch of humor in mm-hmm. some aspects, but it's still, you can tell that, you know, she's putting on airs, she's putting on a face. Yes. And as soon as there's no one else to see that face,
it fades.
She's back to the terror that she's feeling inside.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting, especially, I think, for me, watching this silent, really silent, which is not the way it's meant to be watched, right? It's meant to be watched with some music played in the background. And I think the version that we have on the Orphan Entertainment YouTube channel, the music, I thought, felt really pretty good for, you know, each moment that was happening. But because I watched it first totally with silence, it was interesting because there was nothing to distract or to hint at what was going to happen next. And I think I found it a lot more enjoyable that way, because then I was just caught up in the characters. There was nothing else to distract me or entertain me. It was just whatever was happening with the character, I was in that with them. It's really an interesting way to watch a movie. I actually really recommend it. And this is a great one to do that on. If you haven't watched it yet, consider it. But you do have to pay attention. It's not like, you know, you can wander away for 5 minutes and then come back. You'll miss something. But it is interesting. They keep going like kind of into humor. They go, it's drama and then it's funny and then it's drama and then it's funny. And they keep, I think the pacing felt really good because of that. There's one scene we'll talk about in a little bit that's about 20 minutes long and is heavy, heavy drama. And up until that point, you just don't feel like this movie's going slow. There's always something happening. And the next thing that happens, of course, is she gets arrested and taken to the workhouse. Did you notice the shot when she's in the courthouse, where all you can see is her eyes and up? She's just, they right. constantly through this movie, they shoot it, they film it to make her tiny. They make her small and powerless over and over. When they're showing the shadows on the walls, when they're leading all of the people out to the workhouse, there are all these big, tall, long shadows. And you know which one is her because she's half the height of everybody else with her shawl pulled over her head. And she's this diminutive little creature going by, and you know, but you can tell it's her shadow because she's the only one that looks like this. And she seems like a tiny person to begin with. She's very small. I didn't look up her height. Now I feel like I probably should have done.
I don't know if it's listed anywhere. I'm glad you mentioned the shadows and everything. I read somewhere that the director, Frank Borzage, was heavily influenced by a lot of like the German impressionism directors of the time.
Yeah,
I'm watching this, some of the scenes in this, and seeing how he does with the shadow work and how the shadows themselves are kind of telling a story.
Yeah.
Within the story. I'm like, and you definitely can pick that up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. And of course she gets away, fortunately, and runs and is terrified. And I love the way they get her out of there. You know, you're thinking, how's she going to get away from here? This is this tiny little woman, this little 5 foot tall woman running away from these big, scary policemen. And I think it's interesting. You couldn't have played off how she escapes with anybody bigger. I couldn't have fit in that drum.
No,
I couldn't. And they just like, quick, get in the drum. I was so excited when the drum that got broken in the very beginning of the first scene actually mattered.
Yeah.
This is good storytelling. This is the epitome of what they talk about in storytelling. If it's not important to the plot later on, leave it out. And this is such a clean way of doing it. It's so good.
The drum has its own little story. It does. You see it, you know, as they're walking along and the camera follows it. There's an altercation. Someone gets pushed, busts the drum. Mm-hmm. So the drum head is broken. That allows her to be able to get inside the drum and hide from the policeman with the rest of the carnival guys kind of standing in front of it and everything.
I love that scene too.
And then, so funny. And then, you know, the scene transitions to now sometime later when the carnival is somewhere else in Italy or whatever. And you see the drum and it's got a new drum head. And on that drum head is painted a girl, you know, reclined as if she's in the drum.
Yes.
It's like, oh, it's brilliant. I loved it.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited to talk to you about this movie because, like I said, how the heck do you say this person did a good job writing this silent film? This is how. Because, mm-hmm. and this is, I'm sure, partly direction as well as writing, but the linking of each key element through it is what makes a good movie. Because when you get into where something is added in there and it doesn't lead to anything, it feels chunky. It feels awkward. This is the complaint that we have about all of these movies that are centered around these comedic acts, these vaudeville acts, is that they don't really have any impact on the story. And so if you can have every single detail in it actually has an impact on it, that's where you actually, this is your masterclass in directing for the day. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. It does need to have, it needs to lean to something. This is a brilliant, brilliant example of that. that this whole movie couldn't happen if that drum hadn't been broken in the first. This is the stormtrooper. This is the shot at the beginning of Star Wars. Yeah, this is what it is. If that drum didn't get broken, this whole movie couldn't have happened.
Exactly. It's interesting that you said you watched this silent with literally no sound. There are moments. I watched it with the music playing, and the music also includes, in some manner, some sound effects.
Whistling,
knocking, even if it's not really in time with the scene or whatever, but it's still there. Was watching the actors, and particularly Gaynor, and there's sometimes and some scenes where you're watching her and you're watching her act, and you feel like you're watching a very modern movie with the sound turned down. There are moments where she just feels very modern and just very, you could see this scene and you see the way she acts. A little later, after she's joined the carnival, and they're stopped somewhere, and then she happens to the look and she sees our Gino, as we come to find out, over on a bridge. You're just like, well, wait, they can't stop here because we're setting up here. And she goes over to confront him and she gets all huffy with him, and then she ends up getting knocked down by his goat, and she knocks. she takes his painting and throws it down and stomps on it.
The
expressions on her face and her actions. It's like this would happen today. This is a scene from a movie from today.
His goat knocks her over and she yells at him. Yeah. And she's like, oh, fine. Yeah. You're going to laugh about your goat knocking me over. Fine. I'm going to destroy your painting. And you get you have that dialogue applied, even though it doesn't exist.
Yes.
You can see, gosh, their facial expressions. And I love that. I think what I meant when I said I expected it to be in pantomime is, you expect them to have a lot of facial reactions, and a lot of movies do this now, especially very bad movies. I watched a lot of bad movies lately. Bad indie movies where you can tell the director doesn't really know what they're doing. Somebody will say something and then you have the reaction shot. And it's just a person totally still with a look on their face or whatever it is. And you don't have that in this movie. In this movie, everybody's reacting and talking while they're reacting. They're moving, they're behaving, they're responding, they're living. And you don't have the pantomime because there's not a moment where somebody says something and then everybody stops and waits for the reaction. And I think that's what it is that makes this feel so modern, is that during this time period, and it's worth mentioning, we covered The Jazz Singer a few months back on this show. This was done the same year. And The Jazz Singer, phenomenal movie, right? It's got some reasons for being, of course, one of the best to love movies in film history. And there's a lot of, important history. I'm going to say history six more times in the sentence into it. But it doesn't feel modern.
No.
And this, it doesn't feel like modern acting. And this feels like modern acting.
Yeah.
And I'm agreeing with you in a much more verbose way.
We've seen it in some other silent films. Even The Iron Mask, which was, I think, one of the first silent films we covered. And it was the first silent film with a little bit of talking in it or whatever. For the most part, it was a silent film. But even that one, I felt like all the acting was to the back of the room.
Yeah. And like on a stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like as if it were on a stage play. And I think you kind of go into a silent film expecting that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This film, it's not there. I mean, there are some truly subtle moments and stuff in this film that if you're not paying attention, you'll miss. Mm-hmm. And I think that also is what makes us feel very modern.
They spend so much time focused on her eyes, and not the dark and light, not the shadows over the forehead and the nose, but just a steady shot of her face as she's feeling. And it's just emotive. And I mean, like making big hand gestures while I'm saying this, trying very hard to make my words as big as my hand gestures. But it's, I feel like in this era, there are so many movies where they're focused on the action and not on the emotion. And I think this probably made it really easy for her to win this award, because when that's what you're focusing on, that's, you know, where people feel it, right there in the gut. And yeah, I totally agree with you. There are moments in this that there are some things in it that definitely feel a little bit dated, but they, Gino paints her picture. He says, "I want to paint you." She of course says no. And I think that's another thing. There's some really good resistance between them. Mm-hmm. I think in this era, again, you have a lot of, "Oh, you're a beautiful woman. You know, I'm in love with you. Oh, you're in love with me. I am in love with you too." Where in this one, there's a lot of, "I really like you. Oh yeah, get the heck away from me." And I think that her reactions there too, I think, lend to that modern feeling, because we're so used to what people term insta-love in movies of this era. And she really resists him for a while. And when he does paint her picture and she looks at it, you don't see the picture for a very long time. You don't see the painting for, I don't know if it's a full minute or more, but you see her looking at it, and first she's delighted. She's thinking like, "Oh, this is so beautiful." And then she's kind of retracts that. And she says, "That's not what I look like. I don't really look like that." And he says, "You do to me." And then you get to see the painting. But they have this resistance for her. She's very resistant to him. Until she breaks her ankle. Well, I guess until they're talking then. I love this little moment too. The leader of the circus is like, "Hey, you know, Angela, come on, you're on, come on." And she's like ignoring him, like just about to kiss Gino. And he's like, "Come on, if you're going to kiss him, just freaking kiss him. And then come on, you got to hurry it up."
Yep, thank you. I only wrote a few little notes and everything. And that was one of the lines that I wrote, one of the title cards I put in here was, "Oh, 1,000 devils, kiss him if you must, but make haste."
And this is a line right now, watching a number of bad movies with my husband. We'll just be sitting there and watching, and there'll be something ridiculous going on the screen. You know, two people, like, they look like they're trying to fight, and we'll just be like, "Kiss him." And this is essentially what the circus director does. He's like, "Kiss him. Come on, move on with the story." It's so funny. I love it.
There is another line that I think it was a little before this, when Gino first joins the troupe, and they're riding in the little they're riding in the carriage and it going along the road. He says that love is like measles.
I love this line.
Once it comes, you can't stop it.
I love that. I thought I'm going to use that from now on. That's going on my next anniversary card. There's not a lot of dialogue. There aren't a lot of dialogue cards in this. And what there is to the point, which I appreciate. The other thing, you mentioned it feeling very modern. It moves along really quickly. Angela takes a tumble. She breaks her ankle. And there's some obvious film trickery involved, where she's supposed to be on some really high stilts. And we spot it super easily. At the time, probably people didn't notice it as well.
Right.
We've just learned what to look out for on film. But when she falls, I love it. She looks like she fell. She's dirty. She's like out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that, you know, it's not that frosted glass, that soft focus with her arm up, you know, draped across her forehead dramatically. She's like out, and Gino's freaked out, and he's grabbing her and like trying to wake her up. This is, again, like we could keep saying over and over why she's a good actor and why she deserves this award. Basically, the whole movie is a testimony to that. And then they move on. They go back to Naples, and they say goodbye to the circus people.
Yeah.
And pretty quickly she, you know, is on the mend. And there's a moment in it, you mentioned it feeling very modern. She's helping Gino get his boot off. And I thought, that's what I do every night with my... No, I'm kidding. That's not what it was. No, but after she gets his boot off, he's, you know, sweet talking her, and she puts her hand on his face and smushes his face. And I immediately, this is for reals, I thought, that's exactly like me and my husband. Just hand in the face, like, meh. And I was thinking at this point, oh, they must be married, because he says, you know, I have to go with you or whatever so we can be married. And I actually was thinking they were already married at this point, but they're not.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's time for bed. So she goes to her own quarters. She's got a little small room off of his. I'm like, oh, yeah. I assumed we just skipped the part where they got married.
Yeah.
No, he can't afford to marry her yet, so they're not married.
But I'm can apparently afford to pay for her to stay in the upstairs room, selling his paintings to do so.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really sweet. There are some themes in this movie that are very sweet and that later develop into a real problem. And honestly, I should say there's a theme in this movie that starts off real sweet and then develops into what we would today call toxic masculinity. But this is 1927, so we're not going to get real heavy into that subject matter.
Yes, yes.
But she is still pure as the driven snow.
Yes, absolutely. We mentioned some of the scenes and how she was resistant to him, you know, in the beginning and everything like that, which I didn't mind. I thought that was great. Mm-hmm. But why she was so anti-love and anti-men, there was no reason. There was no element in the story up to that point that would...
You only say that because you're not a woman.
But there's the couple that are inside the traveling carriage or whatever. Like, oh, their velvets are always kissing. It makes me sick. I don't like, you know, love is stupid and I hate men. And like, where is all this coming from? Your mom dies and so you hate men?
Hey, don't underestimate the ability for a single mother to make a daughter hate men. Maybe reading too much into it.
I wonder if there was more story, you know, what is there a story before this, you know, why is she a single mom and caring for Angela, you know, where is the father?
And potentially you could probably make an argument for she, you know, hey, dad left us alone. Maybe dad died, but I still resent him. You can make an argument for nobody would help me when I needed help. These men, you know, rejected me when I was just trying to make a pseudo honest living. Also, these men threw me in jail. These men, these judges, these police, I tried to explain to them I was only trying to help my mother and they threw me in jail. So, you know.
Or at least did she? See, that's another thing that this film doesn't explore is her trying to explain what she was trying to do and the reasons why.
There's not a lot of dialogue during these periods. No. There's a lot of her, and this is part of the brilliance of the movie is that you understand exactly what's happening without dialogue cards. Mm-hmm. That is good direction. We are missing a lot of that. We have in today's film so many explanations, just people just info dumping directly down the camera lens. And if you could fine every director $1 million every time they did that in a movie, it would go away. But
the old adage is always, you know, show, don't tell.
And
in this case, they don't have a choice.
They absolutely, absolutely, in this medium with no sound, the only thing you can do is show. And that's what film is all about. Here we go. Here's your clip for the day. That's what film is all about. It is literally the media that allows you to show. Mm-hmm. No other media before that. Art would allow you to show, but not in a story context, not in a continual story context. Nothing. Well, in stage acting allowed you to do both. The invention of film required you to show what was going on, and it was often done bad, and it's still often done badly. But it's literally, it's the thing. That's the thing. Whether you're talking about a TikTok video or whether you're talking about Lord of the Rings, the longest darn trilogy in the history of the world, if you're not doing the showing part of it, you are cheating your audience. Because that is what they're there for. That's why the screen is 40 feet across, is so that they can see it better. And that is what we aren't doing in film today. That's what makes this podcast the most important podcast on the entire internet.
Absolutely.
I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek, but genuinely, that's what makes film so amazing, is that we experience life through our eyes, through our vision. And it's the only media that allows you to do that in a completely fantastical way. And we just are not doing it very well lately. And to come back to something that was made almost 100 years ago, 100 years ago at the very beginning of this art form, and they're doing it so well. Mm-hmm. This movie deserves to be preserved. It deserves to be put out again. It deserves this storyline happens over and over and over again, right? I mean, if you guys didn't watch this and immediately think of An Affair to Remember, where have you been for the last 50 years? It does what the medium is meant to do. It shows you everything that you need to see. And Janet Gaynor does it in a beautiful way. The director absolutely 100% is responsible for how she is shown on the screen. And I mean, if he hadn't won an award for this, he should have. It's just really well done. You talked a little bit about Charles
Farrell.
Thank you, Charles Farrell. And it was interesting because seeing Janet Gaynor on the screen, seeing her ability to emote, I thought, how are they going to get a guy in here that's going to be able to equal her? And he's funny because he comes in and you get the idea he's kind of this goofy guy. He looks a little funny. Remarkably good-looking man, just in the character, in the role that they cast him. He's got this kind of goofy curly hair and he's dressed a little bit like a vagabond. But he is like, he's like the light to her shadows. And also he's like the 6'2" to her 5'0". They're remarkably different height. And you would think over and over and over that wouldn't work. I've seen Hallmark movies where that incredibly tall guy and very short girl does not work. And it just feels awkward and uncomfortable. But it doesn't with these two. They do such a phenomenal job showing the connection and the fun. I loved mm-hmm. that these two have fun together. That's another thing we see missing a lot in film of this era and later, is people making a connection because they're able to have fun and joke around. It's so fun to see on this.
He comes home after selling the painting. He is not able to get as much for the painting as he wants. Before he can even make it up the stairs, everybody that they owe money to gets their little bit of, gets their lira.
And he stops to buy a flower instead of buying food.
Yes. And he comes upstairs and she's like, well, where's the food? He's like, I kind of forgot it. And gives her the flower. And she's like, I'll go this time. Give me the money. You know? And he hands him, okay. And he gives her like the one bill he has left. And the look on her face is, okay, and the rest.
You know? Yeah. It is also realistic.
They are the cutest little couple. They are this really great. This is a couple that has a true connection. They get each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know. She knows that he's a bit of a goof. You know, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it is really adorable. And he knows he's a bit of a goof.
Mm-hmm.
Later, he's talking about, oh, we're going to have kids and we'll have a girl and she'll be as beautiful and kind as you are. And then, and a boy, and he'll be goofy and would have big feet just like me.
Just like me. Yeah. Oh.
They are an adorable couple. You can see why they were constantly cast together.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a character we haven't even really mentioned. There's also another lady of the evening. The character's name is Lizetta, and she's super jealous, I guess, over Gino. Really, mm-hmm. really interested in getting Gino, which is, I would have liked to have known why. I think this is maybe the one gap in this story for me is, why is she so interested in him? Unless it's just, you know, the women don't appreciate a man until he has a woman syndrome, which is a real thing. Sorry, guys. It stinks, but it's true.
Maybe it's because he's the nice guy. And yeah. I mean, she's not used to dealing with, you know, the nice men.
Yeah, yeah. That's possible. But she definitely has it kind of out for Angela. But I appreciate it that she didn't turn into a whole... I can't even think of a good analogy. She doesn't start like trying to sabotage Angela. She definitely hits on Gino a bit, but you know, she's not in there casting stones. Well, she does. She's not casting stones at first, not until Angela disappears.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Up to that point, I mean, she's trying hard to try to seduce Gino, and Gino will have nothing to do with her. He's not interested at all. Mm-hmm. That I like too. There is no temptation from Gino whatsoever.
I agree. I really appreciate that as well.
Even after Angela has disappeared, and you'd think he'd be looking or seeking some sort of, you know, comfort.
Solace. Yeah.
Or solace. And no, not with Lisetta, not with any other woman. Gino.
This is where that really sweet part starts to sour a little bit for me. He gets all preachy about her method of earning money, and oh, Angela's, you know, worth 10 of you. You're a yucky woman, pretty much. I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. The title card says you're a yucky woman.
it probably says that in the script. Yeah,
in this, yes, the script written. Yeah, they changed the dialogue in post, but but he does. It does then from that moment become and Angela's fear of, if he knows why I went to jail, is weird to me, because she went to jail for appearances, not for actually doing something wrong.
Thank you. That's another little story element here. And this is something that isn't shown or told in this film, is she should have come clean with Gino and go, look, the reason I didn't want to go to Naples is because this. My mom was dying. I was desperate.
Yes.
Nothing happened, but they thought it did. I was arrested, you know.
Now, to be fair, this is a common trope. The secret that shouldn't have been a secret is, knows if this is the origin of it or not, but it's absolutely a common trope. Gosh, all the way back to, I suppose, Arthurian times, right? You know, I didn't do anything with Lancelot, I promise. But if I bring it up, you're going to think I did. You know, the lady doth protest too much and all of that. So I can see her maybe not bringing it up until the police show up to arrest her. Mm-hmm. At which point I feel like saying to him, the police are here to arrest me, but you need to hear why, makes sense. And maybe tricking him into abject drunkenness and trying to slip out the door isn't the best option. And I think this might be where our modern sensibilities fail us a little bit in the comprehension of the storyline. Looking at it in 2024, which is going to date this podcast in 7 months or 9 months, people are going to be like, oh, this is so last year. Looking at it now from modern times, we're going, this is not a big deal. Just tell them. But then, and in some places today, your reputation is everything. And this is a time when, you know, women really didn't have a lot of rights. And I mean, gosh, even today there are countries where if two people are caught philandering, the woman gets the way worse punishment. And that, I mean, I think that was true then. I think it's way more true now. I think if you read, if you're reading things that were written in the 1920s, you can, you know, gosh, we love to talk about like Tarzan, which was written, you know, in the teens and in the 20s. And the treatment of a woman's virtue was really, a woman's virtue is everything. And not only a woman's virtue, but a woman's perceived virtue. So for us, it's really hard to look at this movie and say, why didn't she just tell him? Or I mean, it's easy to say, I mean, why didn't she just tell him? But I think probably in this time, this was a time where if you were brought home past curfew, this is before a time when if you were brought home past curfew, then, you know, wake up, little Susie, you're in trouble. You right. know, we got our parents, we're supposed to be home at 10 o'clock and it's almost morning. We're in trouble. And this is 30, 40 years before that song ever came out. And so I can see why she probably didn't tell him. I can see why she didn't bring it up. Why she didn't, you know, while this man is helping yep. her with her broken ankle, get to somewhere that she can have, she can see a good doctor.
No, you make a good point. Mm-hmm. This is a time when it might be hard for a woman to convince a man that
yes.
all these other men are wrong.
Yeah. Oh, or a woman. At this yeah. time, she went to her, if she, they went to the landlord or the landlady, this is the landlady, my bad, and said, oh, by the way, I was arrested for prostitution, but I actually didn't do it. She's going to say, get out of my house. I'm yeah. not renting to you anymore. Well, actually, she's going to say, good for you. Give me my rent. Because that's what she that's says about Lizetta is, hey, you should look up to this girl. She's paying her rent. It doesn't matter how she makes her money. Yeah. But I think she's probably in the minority in that. yes. And so that was an interesting little moment as well where Angela's like, I can't pay you rent. And she says, go be a prostitute like this woman and then you can pay your rent. That wasn't a common attitude, though. That was not a common attitude
no,
at all.
No, absolutely not.
And so it really rubbed me the wrong way seeing how Gino responded to, you know, inevitably. I don't think there's a lot of reason not to tell you the end of this movie. If you watched the first half and didn't finish the second half, we're probably not going to spoil a lot here for you, but you know, Gino's reaction to finding out that she went to jail for prostitution and like his utter. Now, this is not a man who found out that his girl cheated on him in our minds, right? In our minds, hey, they've never even been together. If she even did it, it was before they ever met, not a big deal. But at this time, it really was that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. You cheated on me. I hadn't met you yet, but you've already cheated on me, which to us sounds incredibly strange. But at that time, that was the norm. So it really, 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 really bothered me. Mm-hmm. But as we're talking about it, this is what's so great about talking over these is that I go, oh, well, I mean, do I think that the attitude at the time was appropriate? Not really, but was it the attitude at the time? Yeah, it was the attitude at the time, and this movie makes a lot more sense to me right now.
And at least those elements make it a little bit more powerful when the two are reunited.
Yes.
Yeah. And she's like, look into my eyes. You can see I'm not the person that you think that you're imagining I am. And he completely breaks down, and no, absolutely you're not. And you know, does he believe her, or does it just not matter because he loves her? You can make up your own mind, I guess.
Yeah, I definitely, I'm on the embankment of the river that says he believes her. Mm-hmm. Because there's a whole little subplot that we aren't even talking about regarding the painting. I think that's a good thing to keep out. If you want to be surprised by the end of this movie, go ahead and watch it. We're leaving you a little tidbit.
Yeah. But it's another really great, you don't know why something's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you see, and again, it's a visual medium and they do a wonderful job taking advantage of that by the information that they leave out. Mm-hmm. They give you a lot of suspense and a lot of curiosity. There are little tidbits going on throughout the whole movie. And you're kind of wondering, okay, what does this have to do with the end? But again, it ties it together so well. The thing that couldn't possibly have happened without the thing that happened. They do a great job of that. But I definitely fall on the side that believes that he decides that she's telling the truth and is actually pure as the driven snow and therefore a viable candidate for marriage and impregnation.
Yes, worthy of being a wife. Yes.
Yeah. If you could see my face right now. But all of that to say.
I was concerned we would have a hard time filling this episode, but we have been talking for over an hour.
Well, which is more than they did. Just kidding. Yes. But I'm sure. I want to mention...
Well, because I was concerned. I wouldn't be able to insert any clips or anything. Or like, oh, are we going to have enough to say? Oh my gosh, we've had plenty to say.
Lydia had a soapbox. Everything's right in the world. I do want to mention real quickly the policeman in this. Police Sergeant Neri is who he is. And it's really interesting. I'm not going to dig into him very much, but I think he's worth paying attention to. If you watch this movie and didn't pay close attention, go back and watch the policeman. I think he's a really interesting piece in this story. I don't really know much about him. I didn't look into him at all. I definitely should have done. But he's
Guido Trento is the actor.
Yeah, and I think he becomes much more important than you think he's going to be. And yeah. I think his responses to her.
I really like him. I like him that the fact that he is bound by duty, but you could tell he has some sympathy.
Reservation sympathy is the better word there. I agree. Yes. So he's great. Go back and watch him. If you didn't pay attention to him the first time, pay attention to him.
Yes. We should get around to rating this one.
Do we even need to?
No, probably not, because I think it's pretty obvious we both have been really, just really taken by this film and these actors. Mm-hmm. I absolutely would give this a 5. I think this is a phenomenal film and another fine example of if you've never watched a silent film before, this would not be a bad one to start with.
No, I think it would not be a bad one to start with. I almost fall on the other side where I would say start with the bad one. But you know what? We did Harold Lloyd and loved Safety Last. Had so much fun watching that. And so this is a drama. If you hate dramas, maybe not the one for you. No. But if you really enjoy deep human emotion and you're really interested in seeing the evolution of film we missed Women's History Month by a month or two. We actually decided to watch this movie during Women's History Month. And I was like, oh, we're going to miss it. Darn it. But this is such an interesting actor to go and look at. There's, of course, a phenomenal writer. I think the director is really remarkable. It seems like everybody that took part in this went on to do a lot more in film. And it's not a surprise at all. And yes, of course, I'm giving it 5 Othels. How could I not? Because it is a movie. The way we rate that is if we were going to recommend you watch a film in this genre, in this time period, would this be the one? And yeah, I think absolutely this is not the best comedy. This is not the best silent comedy we watched because it's not a comedy. But is this the best silent drama to watch? If you're going to watch one silent drama in your entire life, is this the one you should watch? I haven't seen them all. I don't know. But this one would have a really strong vote for me, I think.
Of the ones I've seen, I think this is the one that I would tell you to go seek out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you mentioned it, and you said it. It's if you're looking for a film that really shows a really great example of the foundations of modern cinema, this is a great example.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Because it... As I said before, there are times where it feels very modern, and it's surprising that it is nearly 100 years old.
Yeah, I think you could make the argument that a lot of films that do that soft focus close-up of the woman showing a really dramatic face, I don't know that this is the one that they're referencing, but I think you could make an argument for it. There's probably a good argument out there for, hey, this is what everybody was trying to achieve every time they did that. Because they're not using special effects to get you to feel her emotion. She just does it. And the framing on it's perfect. The cinematography is excellent. The direction, excellent. So I would love to think that every drama made after 1928 references this movie somehow. I doubt it's true, but it's fun to think about it.
Yep, absolutely. Well, do you have any closing thoughts or anything else you wanted to say about Street Angel?
Oh, that's such a great question. Do I have any closing thoughts? No, I think we've covered it really well. I think, Janet Gaynor, it was in a number of other things. I love that Abby Lane suggested one. We didn't know that when we started talking about this movie. When we decided to watch this movie, we didn't know somebody else was going to recommend another movie with Janet Gaynor in it. We certainly didn't realize reading this letter that it's the same actor in that movie as in this movie. So it's going to be a lot of fun, I think, in the future to go and watch a movie that she did that's a talkie. I'm curious what her voice sounds like.
Yeah, no, very much. I was just thinking that earlier, that I'd really like to see her in a talking film. And yeah, this is adorable. Sounds like that'd be the perfect one to check out.
Yeah, absolutely. So hopefully you guys will get to revisit Janet Gaynor with us in the future. Hopefully we'll get to do some more with this director and this writer. If you haven't watched The Lady Eve, go watch The Lady Eve. And the dialogue, every time I watch it, something else jumps out at me. It's just... mwah. It's just to say, as the Italians say, mwah. It's that. So, but yeah, I think we've said it. I think we pretty much said it all for this movie. If you haven't watched it, go watch it. If you love film and are interested in direction, and gosh, if you're in a film class, tell your freaking teacher about this movie, because it'd be great if everybody going through film class I had to watch like Blue Velvet. I would way rather have watched Street Angel. I think this is just an exceptional example of film, especially from this era.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that will do it for this month's film. I want to thank everybody for listening to us yammer about this. I think, you know, the films that we love the most, we do tend to gush on. And this is definitely one that has had a lot of gushing. Lydia, thank you very much. It's always fun to discuss these things with you.
It's so much better to talk about them with you than it is to watch them the first time. It's so nice to crystallize my thoughts about a movie by getting to talk to somebody knowledgeable.
Yes, and it's so much fun. I have opinions and I have ideas about a film, and it's like, I need someone to bounce that off of. And yes. there's so few people that I can go to talk about a silent film with.
Yeah, and honestly, we keep doing it because people keep listening. And seriously, we really, really appreciate you guys joining us on this one. I think it's easy to look at somebody reviewing a silent film and just go, app, skip. You know, but we appreciate the people that stick around and listen to these episodes, because they're not going to be the most popular episodes, but maybe they should be.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And again, thank you to Abby and Lee for writing and giving us some film recommendations and letting us know where we can find some films that we've been looking for.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate. Again, orphanedentertainment@gmail.com is the email address to send anything to us. And please follow the link in the show notes to all the social media, including Discord, Facebook, Mastodon, Threads.
We're on Instagram. Don't know if you guys knew that. We're on Instagram, too.
Yes, absolutely. So please come and check us out. That'll do it. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. We will talk to you in a month. Bye.
Bye.